And our guest this hour, Chase Klutzke, as we talk about her work, UFOs, and the Star Child Project, and her book is called Admissible, The Field Manual for Investigating UFOs, Paranormal Activity, and Strange Creatures. We'll get into some of that work in just a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Chase Klutzke with us. We'll get to your calls. Chase, let's talk about the book, Admissible. Tell me why you wrote it and how you can use it out there in the field.
I wrote the book basically because I was asked constantly, even your first question in the interview, which is, you know, how do you get started? How do you investigate a UFO or, you know, a Bigfoot sighting? And the bar has been raised at quite a bit out here. So there's a lot of kind of new rules and new things we have to consider. And it was just my way of probably trying to help out and give some advice, things that we've learned over the years when you're putting boots on the ground and getting out there. There's a lot more available to us these days.
Can you also use it for, let's say, ghost investigating?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of the overall theory of the book is it doesn't matter whether we're investigating UFOs or a crime scene. These standards of evidence collection and how to properly interview a witness, it's all the same. I go back to a lot of my training as a private investigator and, you know, being certified and, you know, just learning these techniques of law enforcement of how they process a scene, how do they process the information. The case management is very important. Why go out and spend, you know, all night in a haunt and not have, you know, a concise and proper file of it or a report at the end? You know, we never know what's going to happen, George. So, you know, 10 years from now, if something else very similar happens in an area, these people could come back and grab your reports and you could be proud of them.
Chase, as an investigator, if somebody refuses to take a polygraph test for whatever the investigation may be, and I know that it can't be used in court, but if they refuse to take one, as an investigator, do you think that person's guilty?
I don't. And the reason for that is because we do know that the reliability factor, although high, there is room for you know, some discrepancy and false readings. And truthfully, a lot of people, lawyers will advise their clients not to take one because of this, because investigators would immediately, you know, set their standards on the test result.
But why would somebody refuse to take one if they were indeed innocent? Because, first of all, if they fail, let's say they're innocent, but they failed it, that can't be used in court to get them. So they're not losing anything.
But don't you think it would jade the investigators and, you know, the minute they would fail it, they would think they were lying. They wouldn't investigate the science.
Well, but they still can't, you know, it's not admissible. And the other part is, though, if they're telling the truth and they pass the test, which they should, what does that do to the investigation?
Right.
I mean, Travis Walton passed the polygraph test, and all his buddies passed the polygraph test when he got zapped by a light beam and taken up into a craft, right? It was a crazy story. Some would call it preposterous, but they all passed the lie detector test.
Right.
Fire in the sky.
It's definitely a tool that we would use if the credibility factor, but if you ask Travis, you know, if that helped his case, does it really convince any more people out here that he's telling the truth? I think people kind of make up their mind on a lot of different factors. Travis, I think, is one of the best cases, and my favorite part about his story is he didn't come back and say that this happened to him. It was done before he got back.
Sure.
This story was already out there that, you know, he was, you know, taken by a UFO. He never said that when he got back. You know, he's kind of thrust into this whole field and this whole phenomena, and, you know, and he's had to jump hoops because of the skeptics coming at him and, you know, just the public scrutiny. And, you know, there's such a ridicule factor that he just took every step he possibly could. But there are some witnesses out here, George, that just, they, you know, I'm telling the truth and that's enough, because in the end, where is the proof going to be? If they don't believe me now, is that lie detector test going to change their mind?
We conducted and had done a polygraph test on a UFO case where the guest claims that a alien was peering through a window. And he had a little picture of it. I'm not going to mention his name, but a lot of people in the field probably know who I'm talking about. And we asked him if he would take a polygraph test that we would pay for, and he said yes, he would. And he failed it. He failed it, and then he said afterwards, I set him up. I didn't set him up.
Right.
You know, we went out and got the polygraph test. Tom's the one who hired the polygraph examiner. And the polygraph examiner said he failed the test. Then he said, well, he was on too many pharmaceutical prescription drugs, and that altered it too. And, I mean, you can't win sometimes.
Exactly. And, you know, in that case that you're talking about, I believe there was some truth in the claims, but I believe there was also a lot of deception. And, you know, we'll just leave it at that because we're not naming this person. But
and that person has other legal issues going
absolutely.
On in their life right now, which are far worse than, you know, the allegations of whether he saw something through a window or not with a UFO.
Correct. The lie detector test, like I said, as an investigator, we would love all our witnesses to do this, but there are, you know, many reasons that some won't. And, you know, when I think of Chris Bledsoe, who was kind of blindsided to take one. He thought he was going to breakfast, and, you know, there were investigators there that kind of set him up and actually had a lie detector test waiting for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, he went in, and he missed one question. One question was, you know,
and so he failed because of one question?
Yeah, one of his answers kind of came out that it was, you know, a little foggy, and, you know, they declared him completely a liar. And, of course, none of us believe he is. You know, over the years, his case has been reexamined by, you know, professional investigators and people that, you know, understand admissibility and the burden of proof and probative case management. And he's absolutely telling the truth. So, you know, when you're hearing these stories, you know, it was great for Travis Walton, but, you know, for Chris, it was horrible. It was the one piece that those investigators had and decimated this guy and ruined his life.
Well, I just think if you refuse to take one when you're so vocal in some kind of issue or story, it taints it if you refuse it.
Right. Yes, if they're just refusing, if, you know, they come at you with a reason that's understandable why they don't want to take one, you know, would I ask a witness to take a lie detector test? Absolutely. If they refused, it is something you would have to question, you know, credibility. Why are they refusing?
Oh, I know, and it'd be interesting with some of the calls to see if anybody wants to react to that, but I think, and everybody has a right to turn it down, no doubt about that. But the fact that they would turn it down to me taints whatever they claim something to be. Simple as that.
I get it.
Mike, let's go to Mike in Connecticut. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Michael.
Chase, I applaud your work. George, nice to talk to you again.
You too, Mike.
Polygraphs. They can ask you 8 questions, control group, if you will, but there is no right or wrong answer to a polygraph. It's set up like a median, like a speed limit from 40 to, say, 80 miles an hour. There's no right or wrong answer. It's not like, how can I explain this?
They're looking for that thing that goes wavy on those charts, aren't they?
It sets up an average.
Yeah.
If you will, if that makes any sense. And I wanted to make a comment about Stephenville, Texas. That was 2007. Am I correct?
Right around there. That's right.
It only took them a matter of 7 months to get a documentary together, which lasted 2 hours. Now, George, you did a lot of reporting. How do you get something together that quickly? Witnesses, films, film footage,
Well, a lot of news. They got a lot from local television stations. That helped them a lot.
But I was a little suspicious how they got it together so quickly. In other incidents, it takes them years.
Sometimes it does, but in this case, this was covered pretty widely in the news. So there was a lot of video footage and witnesses that they were able to put together a little quicker.
And the third item I'd like to just make a comment about is disclosure. I just think we're being suppressed.
No doubt.
We're never going to hear something or someone's suppressing us from disclosing.
You're right about that, Mike. I've told Steve Bassett the Chase quite often.
We'll never see it. You and I won't see it because we're on the same age as you are.
Unless some whistleblower comes out and tells us, that's the only way we're going to get it, Chase.
Absolutely. But I'm also a licensed lobbyist, the second one in the United States as a UFO lobbyist, Steve Bassett being the first one, and I'm officially registered in the state of Georgia. It's because we don't believe that the politicians are going to assist us in this, we still have to educate them, because I do believe that this is going to be a breaking story. This, we are going to find out the truth. I don't think they can hide it much longer. And what's going to happen then? And we need these people to understand, our politicians, the lawmakers. We need to educate them, and it's why I became a lobbyist.
Do they give you the time of day?
No, not yet.
No, I didn't think so. I mean, what do you call a legislator and say, I want to talk to you about UFOs in your state?
Actually, it is the language that we're changing in that. Basically, I will call and tell them I'm from the Field Reports Science and Technology Investigation Group. And Carrie and I decided to use that title instead of UFO investigators for that opportunity to work within the scientific community. When we send our samples in, we never tell them, we think this is alien or, this comes from a UFO sighting. You guys do DNA? Here's some DNA. Give us the results. Everything's done very scientifically and blind. And we kind of try to approach our politicians that way. Unfortunately, there's such a distaste for lobbyists in D.C. right now. It's hard to even get your foot in the door, but just like when you start out investigating, you're just learning one step at a time until, you hone in your skills and really can kill it and kick a few doors down. And that's what I'm doing very slowly as a lobbyist, figuring out where my holes are, how I'm going to get in that door, who are the people I can talk to, and that takes a little time.
It does. Todd in Houston, welcome to the program. Todd, good morning.
Yes, thank you, George. Hi, Mrs. Chase. I just want to say you're a very nice investigator and very beautiful. And I'd like to ask you, with all your government contacts, do you still talk to all the people you've worked with over the years from the DOD and so forth? And have you ever encountered Men in Black?
Those are great questions. I still have a lot of friends in DOD and also the military. My husband's military, just retired, and so are my children. Both my boys are active duty now. And I've just never had a problem with it. I've never been told to be quiet. I've never had an issue with it. A lot of people didn't even know I did this, although I didn't hide it. When you go to work in a DOD situation or a government job, you kind of leave your personal life on the outside. And I don't really remember talking about it at work. But now that I'm very visible out here, I do use some of those contacts, absolutely. If I'm working on a case that has a radar report, I'll have a couple friends, aviators, fighter pilots, and ask them to help me cipher through, and they're great about it. They really are. And I have never experienced Men in Black personally. I have been followed. I have pictures of coming out of a coal mine in Kentucky, and there's a helicopter. Once again, I don't know if they were after me. It just felt like it was. It felt like it was a surveillance copter because it followed me completely down this entire mountain. And there was another time I was followed late at night, and this was in Tennessee, and you know, I just don't play. I'm not going to kind of shy away from that. I just dial 911 and told them that I'm like a grandmother and I'm all by myself and there's a car behind me and they're just really aggressive and they're making me very nervous and they send a car out, they pull them over, and I had a 10-minute head start.
They did? So, they did pull them over.
Yes, yes, because I was calling and you know, complaining about the behavior of this car.
And you're giving them the exact location, right?
Yes, yes. So, you know, I'm not afraid to kind of pull some stunts every once in a while out there, too.
And did the police come up from behind the person?
Yes.
So they're just zooming up, and they nailed them that way. That's interesting.
Yeah, I, you know, tried to describe the car. I told him I couldn't see the license plate. You know, and the whole time you're taking photographs with your phone. I'm trying to drive, but you know, you reverse the camera, and I'm trying to hit it. And, you know, it was late at night. But, yeah, the cop came right over. I never knew what happened when he stopped them because I just kept going. And I never heard anything about it after that. Of course, I was giggling to myself because, you know, every once in a while, those little victories, it's like,
They're nice. You want to put your hand in the air and go, yes.
Exactly.
That happens sometimes. What has been for you, not that you've investigated, but that you've heard about, the most incredible UFO case?
I think...
Would it be Roswell?
Yes, that's a good one, but I tend to go for the cases that have the most evidence. And that would be Travis Walton. I love Tom Reed. I think he's got an amazing, very, very good case, very well documented. But my favorite case are probably not the most popular ones. You know, the guys up there where they were in the canoe, I can't think of the name of it right now. The Allagash case I'm fascinated with. But I also love the case in Australia, Westall in 66. Where a UFO came down and a bunch of school children were out and saw it.
Yeah, that was great. And also the one, and I believe that too was in Australia, of the kid in the Cessna who claimed that a UFO or an object was coming his way, and then you never heard from him again.
Yes, absolutely. A vintage case. And his fiance at the time, her name is Rhonda, I've got to interview her. And, of course, she was with him as, you know, girlfriend, fiance during that whole event. And I just
amazing.
Love it.
Yep, yeah. Amazing. And then the one I mentioned, the Lonnie Zamora police officer case in New Mexico.
Yes.
That's
one
fascinating.
I've been to that site and it's a good case. It's also a heartbreaking one because his situation and coming forward as a trained observer, a police officer, one of our most credible witnesses, known to be truthful.
Hurt his career.
Yes, absolutely. It's heartbreaking.
It sure is. Jay, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take some final phone calls with you as we talk about UFO investigations and other strange paranormal things. And then next hour, it's Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Chase Klotzke with us as we talk about UFO evidence, investigating the Star Child Project, and so much more. And your phone calls here with our final segment. Back to the burden of proof. When you're investigating an event, who's responsible for finding that, Chase?
That would be the investigator.
So that's your job, huh?
Absolutely. And I think that's definitely the priority, that the mindset you go into. It's everything we're doing is validating and trying to gather as much information as possible and processing it in a way where we're meeting that. We're meeting that burden of proof. And it's a little surprising how many people don't realize what evidence really is, or a Scott's law of how to make your cases to the point where you could probably put that right into a court system and win a case. Absolutely.
Have you ever been on a case that you thought, oh boy, I'm being railroaded on this one?
Oh yes, many. Yes, many.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately, we do have hoaxers out there. You know, Peter was talking about the crank calls he was getting because, you know, some kid probably put a message out on Facebook. And, you know, it's troublesome because we put so much time and money into what we do, and none of us are asking for payment or So it's such a waste of time.
You're not going to get rich investigating the unknown.
No, absolutely not.
You do it from the heart.
Yeah.
First time caller, Mark in Cross Village, Michigan. Hey, Mark, thank you for calling.
Hey, you know what? We're in your beautiful home state of northern Michigan, and we're up here at the tip of the map. We just bought a lighthouse, and we have USOs up here.
I love it. I love it.
So I want to know about USOs.
You got it. We've talked about that before, but we'll do a little bit now. Submerged UFOs, a lighthouse. I got to come up there and see that one day.
Right?
Have you investigated any of those, Chase?
I have investigated the lighthouse in St. Augustine for paranormal activity, but that's the only one I've personally investigated.
They're amazing because you can, and, you know, Navy sailors, for example, on ships have seen these things in the ocean, underneath the water, with these incredible lights just going. I mean, how strange to see, huh?
Right. It's one of my favorite cases when we get these UFO, USO reports. You know, my husband's a submariner, so I kind of have a fondness for things under the ocean. And I think, you know, for me, it's conclusive. When you think of underwater bases, are they real? Well, think about the technology in a submarine, how they could stay out there for 20 years if they needed to, if it wasn't for food. And is it possible? Is it possible to have these structures or vehicles that can survive under the water but also come out into our atmosphere and go into space? And, of course, it's underwater is probably the closest environment to deep space. So it's just interesting, and I do believe that USOs, it's why I loved boarding the Bold Horizon and going out to sea for 3 days, you know, on the Malibu case, because there's so much going on under there, and we just don't have a lot of access like we do on land.
Let's go next to Moses in Tallahassee, Florida. Hello, Moses.
Hi, George. Hi, Chase. How you guys doing?
Good, Moses. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, Moses.
Hi. Yeah, my situation is between the two cultures that's most mentioned, Sumerian and Egypt. Egypt has the most precise information, hieroglyphics and wall paintings, the deer lights and Seti. They had the helicopters and the flying vehicles and submarines. Which culture you feel that shows the complete story of man's, of the interventions of the so-called gods of these beings who came here to advance man?
Well, there's no question. The Egyptians, of course, had their act together, had the library and everything else in those days. You would think they would have documented more UFO cases, Chase.
Right, and I'm not sure that they haven't. When you think of how much information has been obfuscated or taken away from us, especially esoteric type knowledge, from everything from, you know, the Church of Rome, you know, they've had 2,000 years where the conquistadors would go on, and, you know, just like when they decimated the Incas or the Mayans, and they would take all that information, and where would they sequester it? Well, obviously, it all went back to Rome. And so I'm not sure they didn't.
We just lost another good UFO investigator, William Tompkins, who passed away. Great investigator, talked about the secret space program, you know, went public with it. What's the field like with investigators? I mean, as the older people die off, are the younger ones coming in?
No. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that. In fact, one of the biggest goals in MUFON as an organization is to recruit more of these, you know, 20-somethings and 30-somethings, you know, and getting them trained, because we are losing a lot of our older, or what we call veteran ufologists and UFO investigators. And, you know, we really have to pay attention to the Linda Moulton Howells and, you know, a lot of the people that have been out in the field for decades and decades and decades, and they were doing it before it was cool. They blazed the trails for us, and there's so much respect I have for these people doing it when it wasn't cool.
Nathan is in Middletown, Ohio now. Welcome to the program, Nathan. Go ahead.
Thanks, George. Thanks for taking
sure
the call.
Sure thing. You're welcome.
What I wanted to tell you about was I had some UFO sightings about 4 years ago. I had two different sightings, and they were two different types of craft, but something similar between them was that they both times I was woken up from my sleep and kind of directed to either look out the window or, in one case, go all the way out into my back porch in order to see them. And in both cases, I was basically in an altered state.
Hmm.
I mean,
what got you in the altered state?
Well, because I was asleep, and they just kind of woke me up that
way. Okay, okay.
And they never let me be my own functioning person, I guess.
Not under, like, ayahuasca or anything like that.
No, no.
We do hear this
ahead,
a lot. This is a very common report or a statement from a witness. They often feel compelled to look up, or they feel compelled to, you know, get out of bed and go outside. And we do know that there's more of a telepathic type of communication, and it's powerful. It's a very powerful, almost control that they can have on you immediately, and there's not much you can do about it. We hear from witnesses saying, I didn't want to go with them. I didn't want to be in that craft. Or when I first saw these beings around me, I was terrified and wanted them to leave, and they didn't. So what you're saying is how you were compelled and woken up. Unfortunately, that's a very credible or common statement in ufology.
One of the greatest UFO-type stories does not deal with a craft or an alien abduction was the changing by J. Allen Hynek, the consultant to Project Blue Book, where he became a believer, not a skeptic. Mm-hmm. He even set up his own UFO investigation organization and everything else.
Yeah,
what a great story, Chase. Huh?
Yes, absolutely. And again, these guys started with nothing but a belief and a drive to find the truth, whether it was J. Allen Hynek or Walt Andros.
Or John Mack.
Yes, John Mack. Oh, my gosh. What a doll, right? Yeah, these...
Sorely missed.
And we still have a few
Roger
of them.
Roger Lear. All of
yes,
them.
Yes. I think of Lee Spiegel, who actually was at the UN with Jacques Vallée and John Mack, I believe. But, you know, these were big shakers and movers. We had Lee Spiegel sitting in the UN discussing.
I know. Nothing. What happened to Lee? Nothing happened to him, though, right?
No.
Mm-mm. Oh, okay. I thought something happened to him. Jeez.
No.
Don't scare me.
Just meaning that, you know, we still have Lee, but some of these others, you know, we do not. And, you know, it's very important when you're becoming a UFO investigator or a ufologist, do your homework. Know the history. Know the people behind it. You know, read their reports. Listen to their work. It's just very important to have that very strong foundation before we go off even investigating one case.
Chase, how long have you been doing this now?
Been doing it since 1994, and I joined MUFON in 1996. So more as a real organized investigator through MUFON. I learned a lot. Took a little break from MUFON, but I'm back. And
it's a strong organization, and it's a good one.
Pardon?
It's a strong organization.
It is a strong organization. We've taken some hits, especially most recently. But MUFON's going to be standing 10 years from now and 20 years from now. And, you know, we even take the question, you know, if UFOs are disclosed, MUFON's done. And we're shaking our heads thinking, no, we're just getting started.
That's right.
George, you know what's going to happen if we get any sort of confirmation. We're going to be busy.
You'll be deluged. Now, when you say you're taking hits lately, what happened?
You know, well, you have members, you know, that will type inappropriate, extremely inappropriate comments on, you know, social media, and
right.
All of a sudden it's MUFON's fault.
I see.
Type okay. of thing, or, you know, the organization.
The haters.
Well, yeah, there's something to be said, though, when, you know, you make, you know, racial comments. Obviously, MUFON doesn't want these people
of
representing
course not.
Them
no,
or in our
no,
organization.
No call, there's no place for that.
Absolutely, but, you know, we understood that. And, you know, so there's a few hits that we take every once in a while, but it's usually from members. It's never the policy of MUFON or, you know, you just get a rogue member every once in a while. But it is a very solid organization. It's going to be here. It's very successful in its modeling how, you know, Walt Andros started this little group in the Midwest, right, Midwest UFO group, and it's turned into an international not only database, but what separates MUFON from all the others is we investigate. It's just amazing. And, you know, and I believe a lot in the mission statement of MUFON. Again, you can look at individuals in MUFON and, you know, maybe poke a finger here and there, but as an organization, it's good as gold.
Few minutes left with Chase Klotzke, then we've got open lines for the next couple hours here on Coast to Coast. Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
Good. Yeah, I'd like to ask Chase, are Air Force personnel or, you know, those who are deemed worthy of investigating UFOs and stuff like that and ETs, are they familiar with the full set of anomalies that ETs may possess? Like you spoke about the Star Child possessing an elongated head. What other physical features or what other types of heads would they be looking for? Like, let's say if ET was disguised as a human.
The Air Force? Are you talking about Air Force personnel running
Air
into
Air Force
this?
Personnel that are in that area of UFO or alien investigations.
Okay. Probably they have a better outline when you look at some of the papers like MJ-12, which are very controversial. I understand that. But when you have allegedly government papers, whether it's disinformation or legit, talking about 80 different species and going into full detail from a Nordic to a reptilian, tall whites, you know, all the different species allegedly, you know, they either have a whole lot more information than we do and are completely aware of whom they're dealing with versus the public and some of us, or they've got probably the most scientific sci-fi imagination possible because it was just brilliant disinformation. So I think the government, I think the people that are actually working with the UFO topic within our military absolutely are briefed and know what they're dealing with. And of course we hear the stories coming out of Dulce and where they talk about having beings down there. This is going to be, you know, classified, it's going to be brutal. These guys are probably not going to be talking, but I do believe that they have a lot more information.
So what's the latest with the Star Child skull now that the DNA results are in and it's proven to be human? Again, I still question what human means. Still could have come from another planet, but now what happens? Is that it? Is it all over?
It is for Carrie and I because, you know, people want us to, you know, talk about the disease or why is this head shaped like this and what's going on here. But Melanie really contacted us to just make that determination, do a scientific investigation. Is this alien? Is it hybrid or is it human? So for us, it's over. But the next step for the Star Child skull, I'm so thankful that Melanie has taken such a sincere approach. And it's easy as UFO investigators to look at it as evidence, but none of us, and maybe it's the mom in us, but none of us forgot that this was a little boy, whether it was alien or hybrid, this was a living, breathing being on this earth that obviously did not have the most successful and loving existence on this earth. And Melanie is working with Ruben Uriate, right now, trying to have the remains patriated back to the Delicia, Copper Canyon area, Chihuahua, Mexico.
Well, I tell you what, get it all done. And Chase, thanks for being on the program. Chase's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'll be back in a moment. Open lines on Coast to Coast AM.